You said the public. No, you said that.
Please.
Okay. Well, we can both stand until another chair comes. You should have been so popular, Thomas, and we'd have a chair. We'll just wait for the chair, and then we'll start.
There is a chair coming.
There is a chair coming. Janet promised us a chair. Here we go. That's great. Thank you very much, Mike.
Okay,
thanks a lot.
There you go.
Right. Okay. What a terrific film. Thank you very, very much. I wanted to start at the end, which is also the beginning, because you begin with the course of Mark Teller and you end with the course of Mark Teller, and you talk at the end about how the end is also the beginning. Through the film, you've traced a number of different trajectories, including a story about architectural modernism, family histories, and so on and so forth. We might talk about that a bit more in a minute, but I just wondered. I mean, my understanding is that the setting up of the foundation was also the beginning of this film, which has been 10 years in the making. I wondered what.
Okay, can I interrupt one second?
Yeah.
I need to speak a bit more.
Okay.
I mean, people at the back, I think.
Okay.
So you just need to project your voice a little bit towards that way too.
Okay.
Thank you.
I just wondered what led you to make it as a film.
Well, as you say, it's a long history, and. The reason why I wanted to put in this phrase about destruction can also be creation is that, of course, the big irony is if the ECB had not acquired this particular piece of land from the city of Frankfurt, and if their architect had not proposed to cut it in half, we wouldn't be having a Martin Elsner foundation. And we wouldn't have a film, or indeed any of the other activities that the Martin Elsner Foundation felt itself obliged to undertake in those 10 years. So there is a, you can say it's an irony, it's a superficial irony, but I think it's also a deeper recognition about the way that film can both be something very creative when it brings back a form of life, people's lives, fates, and so on, brings it back to life. But also, film is also something that can be very destructive, because that which it is captured is then handed over to its own fate. Mm. And one of the things that people have always said to me, well, now that you know all this, don't you want to rebuild the house on the island? And no, I don't want that at all. So there are these layers about, you know, when you reflect about something like this, there are these layers where you're confronted with, on the one hand, extraordinary coincidences and accidents of fate. Mm. I mean, now the material all seems to fit together as a story, but it really took 10 years. To make it fit like that, or to even understand how it might fit together. I mean, just the story about how those letters of my grandmother came back into my possession would make a completely different film. Or that I found very late in the process that I had actually interviewed my mother 20, 30 years ago about aspects of her life. And then replaying this, I found these bits of her voice where she describes how she came to the island, or how she met my father, or how my father wasn't really the man in her life at all, and in fact that she really only married him because she wanted to be close to my grandmother. So all these things, you know, give give a not as just layers to the film, you know, like the way I talk about it unpeeling, but also create kind of dissonances, you know, moments of tension and conflict where you say, how does this fit together? You know, so what appears as if it was a fairly chronological narrative, at least that central part of the island, I hope it's clear that it's not at all a story that naturally evolved. That I want that feeling that really, how could all this come together like this? And of course, there's a lot of stuff that's not being told because some of it is so bizarre that really one would think it was made up. So the only thing that I actually brought in that makes that a little bit clear is the peculiar story about Rex and Irmgard, the writers, and how you know, he was already dead when his son was born, and how it was that he then saw his father for the first time alive in a movie theater or on my computer. So it's those things that brought me to it. But to answer your question more broadly, the film came about not because I suddenly discovered that I was a filmmaker or wanted to be a filmmaker. Quite the opposite. I usually say, I'm not a filmmaker, I just happen to make a film. That was because in the Martin Elser Foundation, once we had agreed to an out-of-court settlement, the condition of making that out-of-court settlement was to have a foundation, because the city of Frankfurt paid into it. The ECB can't pay into a foundation, but they can support certain activities from their budget. I mean, they gave 100,000. Now, 100,000 is not even stamp money for them. I mean, the project, these two towers, cost 1,500 million euros. I mean, monstrous. Mm-hmm. So 100,000, you know, what is that? But the 100,000 allowed me, for instance, to transcribe those letters of my grandmother, who were actually in Gothic script and illegible. Mm-hmm. But that was 25,000 euros to transcribe those letters. Mm-hmm. So once you make a film, the taxi meter really starts running. And so without the ECB, this film wouldn't have been made. So it's another of those ironies that, you know, thank goodness that they took the decision that they did.
Well, can I pick up on that a little bit? Because that's a big story, and there's a big story that's kind of encased in that building about what has happened to the legacy of internationalism in the sense in which it was conceived in the period in which Martin Elsässer was designing the building, the international style, a particular kind of utopia about modernity that's then replaced and displaced and fractured by this other story about the ECB and what that represents about sort of a globalized moment in international capitalism, whatever. But that's just one of many big histories which intersect in your family life. There's a whole story, I think, about Weimar modernism and modernity that's sort of emblematized, I suppose, by these figures. There's a whole story about sexual liberation, I think, and the figure of Liesel, who is extraordinary, really. You know, lots and lots of big histories. Mm. I wondered how, and clearly, of course, also the story of Grandmother Sommer and mm-hmm. her internment and extraordinary escape. So she's not deported. She returns after the war. So a story about National Socialism and the genocide against the Jews. How did you decide in the editing process to play up or play mm-hmm. down those stories? How much archive footage were you using?
Yeah, I mean, the big problem for me was that the film was actually produced with a Frankfurt producer and with ZDF, Dreisat, the second German channel. Now, they said, we can only make this film or finance or co-finance this film if it has enough about Frankfurt, and if the ECB is quite central, because that was the big event of those years when the film was in the making. But for that period, I didn't have any material. So the question was, how am I going to get from Frankfurt and the central market to the island? And that took years. Well, it took a year for me to figure out what could possibly be the link. And so originally the link was that the Großmarkthalle was for fresh vegetables, and Migge was all about vegetable growing and recycling and farmers markets and subsistence gardens. And I wanted that then to be part of this other story, namely about the protests against austerity and the whole crisis around the euro. And so I had this big plan of how Martin was ultimately on the side of the ECB, because he was basically grand bourgeois, whereas Migge was on the side of those protesters, and that Liesl was the figure in the middle who was mediating and who had a much clearer political sense, which she did actually. She was the one who already in 1931 said, Hitler is the wrong savior for Germany, which at that time was pretty extraordinary. And she was saying in a letter to her lover, Migge, who was actually leaning more towards the National Socialists, because the National Socialists were actually more sympathetic to the kind of green politics than the communists were. These are the things that, you know, one then learns about other stories, not the big stories as you say, but that the green movement in Germany was more brown than it was red. So all that had to go out, and I also decided that the grandmother Sommer story has to be very much in the margins. I didn't want that to kind of take over. And of course now when I show the film in New York, they say, where are the Jews? We want to see more of the Jews. That is New York for you. But the producer in Frankfurt said, I want to see swastikas, I want to see jackboots on Unter den Linden, and I have the material for you. And I said, oh my God, no, please, absolutely not.
No.
So there was pressure from the outside,
yes,
of bringing things in that people thought belongs to the period. So how to introduce the war, and what to say and what not to say was one big issue. I mean, apart from how do I create one story out of these two completely separate narratives, and the stories that I then brought in, like the story about my father and my mother, or at a certain point we had this brainstorming, the producer, the editor and myself, and the man from ZDF, and they said, look, you, Thomas Elsasser, you've got to be in there, you have to take charge of this, otherwise the story doesn't make any sense. So I had to craft this narrative about myself as a film historian. How do I actually respond to this material? So these were all things that sort of emerged in the process of bringing it together. Now it seems as if it's only possible like this, but that's the magic of movie making.
But one of the things I think does happen, it happens for me through the film footage, but also the photographs. You give the photographs a lot of time, I think. And so we're allowed to contemplate what a figure like Migge, for example, represents. I think that is one of the things that happens in family history, that individual stories take on their own dynamic, and they tell their own family stories, but they also tell their own bigger picture. I mean, I was fascinated by his term, Binnenkolonisation, internal colonization.
It's very rich, very
it's
rich,
incredibly
yes.
rich.
Yes.
If it's coined at
yes.
a time
yeah, yeah.
when Germany loses its colonies, you know.
Yes.
But
when a movement arises that wants to make the whole of the East into a colony.
Exactly, exactly.
So it's partly already the discourse of expansion. And at the same time, you can see that he was not entirely in favor of that by calling it bin colonization, yeah. Internal colonization. But you see, you mentioned the photographs. Well, Migger died in 1935. My father bought his camera in 1940. There is no material of Migger. So even to find these six photos where Migger's on the island was an accident, and it now is absolutely central. If you don't see Migger on the island, how would you believe that he had anything to do with the island, especially since, as my sister says, we grew up thinking that there was no Migger, and it was all my grandmother and my grandfather and my mother and my father. So you know, those, you know, suddenly you see the photographs have actually, you know, a vital role to play in creating the story. Yeah. But then, as you say, they take on their own life, and then they are there for a reason. That it slows things down. It gives you that space of contemplation and reflection.
And there's also, I mean, in your work on media archaeology, for example, you've talked about pieces of technology, gadget, you know, sort of the technology around vision, which represents a certain kind of utopia at a certain moment in history, and that's happening very much with Migger's gadgets. I particularly like the Metro Claw, which is on one level a utopia that sort of resurfaces later in the Green Movement. But
that's very actually it's even more. I had a whole sequence of that because even though. You see, there was this phrase that you find in it. Well, Migger, actually, when I started, Migger wasn't known. Mm-hmm. There's another complete accident that I had to leave out, and that is that in 2004, just as this happened, I was giving a talk in Berlin on Fritz Lang's Metropolis and Bert Brecht's Kuhle Wampe. And where I had actually sort of turned it around. Usually, Kuhle Wampe is the good object of Weimar cinema, and Metropolis the bad object. Now, I turned it around and actually made Kuhle Wampe the bad object for a very specific reason, namely that if you look at Kuhle Wampe from the perspective of Migger and recycling, you actually realize that Kuhle Wampe absolutely does not want the working class to be doing their allotment gardens. They want to keep it in the tenement houses in Berlin to keep the revolutionary fervor active. So they thought all this stuff was petit bourgeois. At that time, I didn't know any of that. I mean, that wasn't what the talk was about. The talk was more about how I discovered a review of Siegfried Krakauer of Kuhle Wampe, where he was actually making some. Now, at the time, it seemed rather bitter and ungenerous comments, but if you bring in that story about how the left, the KPD, fought the SPD, the Social Democrats, even more than they fought the fascists, then you realize there was some problem that Krakauer spotted. But in the audience of that talk was a young man who came up to me afterwards and said, I happen to be here because a friend brought me along, but I was intrigued by your name, Elsasser. Do you by any chance know a Martin Elsasser? And I said, well, yes, it happened to be my grandfather. And he said, let me introduce myself. My name is David Haney. I'm writing a monograph on Leberecht Migger, who appears to be totally unknown in Germany, but you know, I come from Philadelphia, and we have some garden architects that are very keen on this experiment. And do you know anything about Migger? Well, I said, well, actually, not much. But what we did actually hear in the family was that he had an affair with our grandmother. And he said, what? So that to him was completely new. And then I introduced him to the island project that he knew nothing about, because the Migger family had completely suppressed all this material or this story. And what's more, he was very interested in whether Mige, in his last years of his life, was going actually full tilt with the National Socialists, or whether he was still faithful to his Bolshevik teens and 20s. And I found a letter, and how I found the letter I won't tell. I found a letter where Mige actually writes to my grandmother, "I saw Martin Wagner this afternoon." This was 32. And we said, a moment of decision has come. This was after elections, when the Nazis actually won for the first time something like 30% of the vote. And Martin Wagner, it's a city planner, one of the most important Berlin city planners, and he was an absolutely committed socialist. And in the letter it says, "We decided to split amicably. He stays with the left and I go to the right." And I actually found that written in the letter. Hmm. And David embraced me and said, "Oh my God, the smoking gun."
Okay, well, I think that's a good moment to open up. I could have other questions, but I think that there are a lot of people here and I'm sure you have questions. So can I invite contributions or questions or comments from the floor?
I have a question about what you mentioned in the film about watching the home movies as a child. Did you have possession of the home movies? And what memories do you have of watching them?
Well, the home movies were shown when there were visitors, but I cannot remember my father ever discussing them. And they were just shown in their raw state. I mean, he never edited them into anything more than these bits and pieces that we see. And I'm still intrigued by the fact that he never commented them. And so we just saw those films and said, "Oh, there's Uncle Gert, or there's Tante Ursel," or, you know, but this was just it. Or seeing our parents, you know, there was nothing else. This was purely, you know, stuff that just reminded us of a family history, nothing of the wider context whatsoever. So, and why my father gave up filming in the mid-50s is also a mystery. I mean, he was obviously, I mean, not obviously, but now I realize he was very good at it.
But did you keep the films in your possession?
Well, yes. There's another story to it, very briefly. I left Germany in 1961, and already in the late 50s we didn't see these films. There just was no occasion, no interest, whatever. Now, in 1989, my mother turned 80, and my sister and I wanted to do, you know, a kind of view of her life. And then I thought, oh wow, we have these. Somewhere there must be these home movies. My father was already dead then. So we dug this out, and that is when I had them transferred onto video. And I made a film about my mother. And I incorporated some of those movies. And this was a big party in Alsace, where my parents had moved to. And halfway through showing this film, my mother stormed out and wasn't to be seen again for the rest of the evening, which was terrible. I mean, we had about 80 people there, 60 people, and she was not to be seen. And I was totally in shock until I realized that we had mentioned that she was Jewish, which she had not been very keen to let people know, especially not in the village, because, as you may know, Alsace, or may not know, Alsace is completely Le Pen country and has been ever since the Second World War. It's the most right-wing, anti-Semitic département, or almost, of France. And so we had blown her cover. We had exposed her. We had made her life impossible in this village, which was only about 20 miles from where she was born, because one of the reasons she forced my father to have a property in Alsace was she wanted to be back home. And imagine the shock. Back home she had managed, because by that time in Alsace they had readopted the Alsace dialect. In other words, although they were fully French, they spoke Alsace, which is a version of German, and what my mother grew up with. So she was actually home always also linguistically, and suddenly, we idiots. So then those films were buried again. I mean, they were toxic, you see. And only for this project then did I bring them up again and had them then digitally restored or transferred.
I have a question. You talk about your father's talent in constructing the sequence of frames and constructing the perspective. So how did you find the balance? Because obviously you had to construct your own sequence, and I assume that you had to intrude into the primary material. So was it complicated?
Very little. I did very little editing. You know, I actually looked for those pieces that you know, like the scene, for instance, where I say he has a tripod and he walks into the frame. You know, I quite like that. Or I took scene. Obviously, I've used about, I would say, 60% of the material in the film, and I was looking for the pieces that were most continuous. I can't. Maybe I think I slightly edited the scene in the morning when my father is eating his porridge and my mother is getting up. I think I had to rearrange that slightly, but that was, you know, only rearranging what obviously was the meaning of the scene. You know, he hadn't done any editing, so I didn't think that I was actually imposing something on the sequence. But very, very little. That was the surprising. I mean, for instance, the bull game, where he has a subjective camera. It's actually thrown into the camera, but he's also up on the roof of the house to have the bird's eye view. And so, even though again that I had to rearrange a little bit, the fact that he staged it or filmed it in this way showed me that he did want it to somehow. Convey a particular narrative.
There's one here.
This is a kind of psychoanalytic question, but I think the film sort of demands it almost. Mm. Was it a kind of working through for you?
Yes.
Do you feel that the dead has been, you know, because mourning is a form of putting bodies in the grave and finding symbolic forms for transgenerational contaminations,
mm-hmm.
that you aren't even aware of but have played out in your life in some way. For instance, you going into film history, you know, you can see now that in some ways that was a
right.
transgenerational contamination that you weren't even aware of until
yes.
making the film.
Very good question, thank you. I have to go back a little bit. The fact that I brought myself in as a film historian was a piece of artifice, due to, as I said, the producer saying, you've got to be in there, and I had to construct a persona for myself. But I realized that if I, and it is truthful that we didn't talk about movies, if I were to make this part of the story, I would actually have something very interesting, namely three father-son relationships in the film. One, the one between my grandfather and my father, which was obviously totally Oedipal, as that letter, which again I found relatively late, and then had to, I saw the footage of my father and my grandfather being together, where my father takes the axe out of his hand and then swings it like that. I thought, wow, this is heavy stuff. And then the letter where my grandfather says, look, I understand, you have to rebel against the father, but don't you realize that's partly because you haven't fully become yourself? So please, it's a longer letter, so I've taken that part, where he says, okay, I'll try harder not to be so irritated by you being irritated with me, but you too have to work on this. So the working through of my grandfather, my father. That's definitely there. And then the third one is, of course, the Rex story and the son who never saw his father. And because this man was such a womanizer, the mother had not told the son much about his father. And indeed, as I now find out, there's another story that only happened about 2 months ago, because I am very much interested in making this the work. What my actually, I have to go back a little bit. My work now, as part of the foundation, is to valorize my grandfather's life and work. But the truth is that as I was working on this, my grandfather was the least interesting person of all these in the family. And so I thought, I'm very interested in Migge, and Migge is very topical because of the green movement. He is actually a grandfather of the Greens, and urban gardening and all that, you know, it's, I'm not sure how relevant it is in London, but it's certainly in Berlin and in Germany, it's top. And even more so, and Eric, I mentioned that, I am completely bowled over by the letters of my grandmother. They are such amazing historical documents, but also literary documents. But in order to actually do something with those letters, I have to first boost the two men in her life. You see, I have to bring them back into some kind of public sphere, because I can then attach her. You see, so in that sense, maybe you're right that this is a working through, but, you know, I personally don't have beef with either my father or my grandfather. You know, I mean, I'm making this film at a stage, an age in my life when my grandfather was already dead, which is also very bizarre. You know, I'm 75 now. He died when he was 74, you know, and I am now reinventing myself as a grandson. So, you know, you can say this is pretty psychoanalytic one way or another, but you see, I would do it actually as a film historian, as somebody very interested in media archaeology and archives. I would do this for anybody, you know, that it happens to be my family because I own this material and because I'm the head of the foundation. But emotionally, I don't think I'm as close as I had to make the film, make myself to be close, if you see what I mean.
Good question here and another one here. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the film. A couple of questions. Was your mother, like, when did she die, basically? When?
My mother had the ripe old age of 102, and she died in 2012.
Okay, so you were already working on this project then?
No.
You said it not on 10 years.
Not on the film. No. I was
10 years to do.
Yeah, we were working on. Now, the 2007 when I visited the island. Yes, there she was still alive, but she also said, "Don't touch this stuff. This is the past. I'm not interested." My mother, oddly enough, waved this away, and this wasn't because of the Jewish side. We had made our peace again. That was 4 years that my mother didn't talk to me, which was pretty. Shows you how strong a woman she was. She was pretty severe. But basically, she said, you know, you have such a rich life. Why do you go back to all this stuff? You know, and so she wasn't that supportive. And the recordings I had made much earlier. So, sorry, but
Her voice recording.
Her voice recording, yeah.
Yes, of course, I know that. But I was just wondering, because of the incident in the home in Alsace, how she took the fact that you were embarking on this much bigger project,
her. As I said, by that time we had made our peace. Yeah. You see, one of the interesting historical things is that in 1989, Germany was not yet as talking about Jews and the Holocaust than it was after Unification 90. And my mother actually, bless her soul, benefited in the last years, after, you know, from 80 to 102, she lived another 20 years, she benefited from being Jewish. It became a kind of magnet, not so much for the French that she was living with, but for the friends of my sister and people that I brought to the house, you see. that suddenly she realized being a survivor and being, you know, having the story was actually a cultural asset for her. And she was pretty narcissistic and didn't mind one praising her, so that sort of worked out quite well through that historical shift from not talking about the Jews to only talking about the Jews in general.
Or maybe even cathartic secretly. I don't know.
Maybe, but she was too, first of all, she was into denial on so many fronts that I'm not sure whether she really would have appreciated the idea that she had to go through a cathartic process.
And the other question was, you know, with the Meagher family, he left all his inheritance to basically your grandmother and everything, like the island, but also his his estate or whatever.
Well, not quite.
Not everything.
What happened? Okay, I have to fill you in on that. What happened?
I was wondering how Hayes family took it.
Yes. What happened was, and see, all these things I couldn't bring into film. What happened was that he died when my grandmother was with him in Flensburg, because there was the specialist for bladder cancer. So they went to Flensburg, and that's where he died. Obviously, my grandma had to tell his wife that he was dead. And the wife, who was a pretty strong character, Andrea herself, sent one of the sons to Flensburg to snatch the body, brought it back to Worpswede, and had a doctor certify that he died in Worpswede. And then she went about destroying everything she could lay her hands on, everything in the Berlin atelier, his papers, and she had the bulldozer come and destroy the son estate, the Sonnenhof. She was so angry with him that she was going to destroy his life's work. So there is no Meagher archive. I sit on more papers that are authentically Meagher than anybody else.
Hang on, I'm going to have to bring in some other people, so can I go over to here?
Thank you very much. Thomas, as you know, I've seen this film once or twice before. This is definitely the best version. I still think you could... You cut out 10 minutes, yeah?
I need to cut out another 10 minutes,
I think
I know.
You do, but I think it's really good. So
I'm getting there.
Actually, you just mentioned the word denial. This does resonate with a question before. The film, lots of wonderful things about it, and not that. And the film also seems to me, it's sort of about denial of various members of the family, and also I'm wondering to what extent your own, and also that the whole section, and this is the conversation we've had already, so I hope you'll forgive me, but I don't think it's given that the war is not mentioned more in the film. And in some way, you know, there's sort of life on the island when the tempests and hurricanes and atrocities of war are raging through Europe. There is a massive denial on the part of the family, surely. That's my first question.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, the personal denial, even obviously on the part of the husband, the grandfather, but also perhaps, I wonder, of your own feelings, which are not in the film. And when you talk about the other relationships in the film, this, you know, as if there were some people that you met and it's nothing to do with you. You know, this is, we're talking about your grandparents going through a major trauma, drama, in terms of their personal lives. And really, your grandmother betraying your grandfather profoundly. I mean, as a person can betray anybody, really. And you don't talk about it. Not in the film, and not ever. And I'm wondering about that.
Okay, I'll take the first... The first question was about the war. What about the war? Well, that obviously was a big debate with the producers, and I think I held my ground. And if you look at the film carefully, you see that there are lots of hints. And some of them I really like, and I think that's the proper way. Remember, this is a film made for German television, where they've been seeing films about Jews, about the Holocaust, about the war. It's coming out of their eyeballs. And so I thought, if I, the one thing I don't want this film to end up is yet another film about, you know, how terrible the war was, or the opposite, what a lovely war it was, because it was a lovely war for many Germans. Right up, we have the problem of hindsight, and we think they must have known the war was imminent in 1938. Not a bit. Until 1943, they were winning on all fronts. They were having a great time. So the way I wanted to bring this in is, for instance, I found this birthday of my aunt. I had another story that I cut out. Why does she have a white flower in her hair? But I won't tell you that one. But I saw this book, so I pored over that shot until I found which book it was. And it is a book about Notre Dame de Paris. And I knew that the youngest of the sons was actually in France. Now, I have not the actual proof that he bought this book and sent it to his sister. But it seemed to me a very opportune way of actually reminding people that German soldiers were in Paris at that time. And we know what that meant. We've seen the photos, we've read the books and so on. So, you know, this is a film that obviously is not there for instructing you about the war and the Holocaust. It's not there. It's not being shown. It's going to be shown on the 16th of April at 10:30 in the evening, from 10:30 to 12. You can imagine how many people are going to tune in there, and how many people are there who just happen to be hitting on that and discovering the war. So I knew that I had a particular slot to fill, and that was my primary concern at that point. And what I really had to do is to keep the swastikas and the jackboots out of it. But there are the swastikas, you see. I did put just enough swastikas, one on the brooch here, one in the background when my father and the Christmas party, and one or two more. But yes, that was all very deliberate, to just space it like that. And I was so glad to find my aunt and my grandmother chopping wood, because that is Rosie the Riveter. That is women do man's work, you see. So it was, because it was so difficult and I had to counter the pressure from outside, I was very aware how I put the war, and I wouldn't say that it was a denial. And indeed, I hope that's also clear, that my grandparents sheltered a Jewess. And that took some courage in 1940 and 43. And indeed, you know, I was, if not conceived, pretty well born on the island. You know, I mean, that, if you like, the story I'm not telling, other than by just having these pictures, is that obviously this island, you know, is me in that sense. And I had a sequence where I touch a tree, and then I say, this tree must be exactly my age. What does it mean that I can touch a tree that's my age? But I thought it was too corny.
And your personal feelings?
Yeah, it's interesting. As I said, the person I'm in love with is my grandmother, I'm afraid. I'm totally obsessed with my grandmother. But my grandfather died in 57. Well, I was 14. And he was a very melancholy and bitter person at the end of his life. So he wasn't very approachable. He did not hug us, the grandchildren. He was not your nice granddad. And he also always had a cigar, and I loathed the smell of cigar. And so even when we visited, it wasn't all that often that we were close. But I also felt, and this is, I'm now going to give one little, and then we'll end it. I was quite close to my grandmother, but in the letters, I found a description of me as a five-year-old, and she had observed me. You know, I was there for a couple of days. She had observed me, and she wrote, not to my mother, but to Brigitte. She said, I don't think Thomas has much imagination.
Well,
so I thought, oh my God, you know, there I am in love with this woman, and now I finally read what she really thought of me. And then I thought, I'm going to prove her wrong, at least as far as I can.
Well, I think you've certainly succeeded in that, and thank you for some terrific stories and an absolutely terrific film, so I'd like you to join me.
Probably have to clear
space. Just to say, well, thank you for coming. There are still two more sessions of the Essay Film Festival. There's one at the ICA tonight, a Brazilian film about May 68 called In the Intense Now by João Moreira Salles. And then tomorrow night we have this amazing film by Johan Luff, who's actually in the audience with us today, which is a found footage film based on shots of the stars and the sky from the beginning of the history of cinema up until the present day. It is an absolute astonishing piece of work. So thanks for coming to the festival. I do just need to ask you to actually leave in the sense of getting out of the building, because Birkbeck closes for the holidays at 6 o'clock. And I don't want Bernie, who's the very nice person on the door, to have to start going around chasing people out, because sometimes people don't quite get the message. So just politely but firmly, if you could leave and then carry on leaving, that would be really great. Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas.
Great stuff.
And it was